and welcome to edition 356 of the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Tuck, and Robert Bound.
On today's show, we'll be talking to Turner Prize winning artist Wolfgang Tillmans about the German photographer's affection for the UK and why he wants it to stay in Europe and why he's now using art to make the point.
We'll also be celebrating print with letterpress printing master Alan Kitchen, whose striking work has appeared across major news titles and beyond.
And we'll be talking to writer and preservationist Elizabeth Barlow Rogers, the First Lady of Central Park, no less, who'll be telling us why New York's green spaces are the city's natural winners.
That's all coming up. Plus, Monocle's Henry Rhys Sheridan will be taking us on a leisurely stroll through next week's news, and we'll play some good music too, I promise, right here on the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24.
Here we are, Andrew. It's Sunday. It's midday. We're here like brothers in arms.
Oh.
After putting another issue to bed, what haven't we done this week? What haven't we? I know you favour the yellow post-it note. You write things on in the morning. You tick them off by the evening.
I get through a lot of post-it notes.
You get through a lot of post-it notes in a week like this week. It's been a busy one.
We have just about sent the Sydney Travel Guide book with Gestalten to print. Yeah. That's kind of weaved its way out of the office. We've almost finished the Honolulu Travel Guide book. We've been doing lots of promotion for the new Nations book. And we've been doing more radio than you can imagine.
And it's
been.
And do you remember the June issue of the magazine?
I remember
that went
June
out the
June issue.
Didn't it?
And it's been a big old week. I may have been away somewhere. I can hardly remember. By the time. But this afternoon I'm going on holiday. Bye. I'm not here next week.
Oh,
bye.
Dear. Well, we're all going to go on strike. What's going to be happening? It's going to be like a 3-day week at Monocle, isn't it? It's going to be 1978.
It's going to be like Venezuela here at Monocle 24. Okay.
I don't want you to make any. What are you saying? Who's Hugo Chavez? What are you trying to say?
He's gone, Hugo. But they've only got a 2-day working week at the moment. So
have they?
I don't think for good reasons.
Don't be certain. People will be emigrating to Venezuela as we
but
speak.
We wouldn't mind a two-day working week here, I think, next week.
Exactly. All right. You've got 45 minutes. Then you've got 45 minutes. Listen to this show. Then pack your bag, go to Venezuela. 2-day week. Jammy.
Okay.
Why don't we find out what's happening next week then? Because we're wondering what's going
to
happen next week. Why don't we wheel out the one and only Henry Rhys Sheridan? Henry, oh Henry. Taking us back to who knows when. Maybe it's the 30s.
I'm not sure. I've not delved into the origins of that song, although it has caused a lot of discussion on the Monocle editorial floor, specifically pertaining to the interpretation of its lyrics.
What, that you're always ready to drop and rock?
That I think that's indisputable. The Texas Hotline.
Yeah.
That is quite difficult to decipher,
yeah.
Actually.
I was presumed we were using that as your theme song because it was the name of an easy to get and very cheap street drug.
Interesting.
Okay.
Or at least the measurement.
A Henry of.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Anyway, we're moving on.
Okay.
This is a upmarket program.
I'm sorry.
Okay, Henry, where
shall
are we going to
begin?
Yes.
We're going to begin in Porvoo. That's in Finland, where between the 2nd of May and the 3rd of May, Nordic foreign ministers are going to meet to discuss security policy. It's going to be hosted by the Finnish foreign minister, Timo Soini. The foreign ministers of Sweden, Norway, Denmark and Iceland are attending. They're going to be talking about all sorts of things. Migration comes under their ambit. The United States relationship with the Nordic countries, which you don't hear a lot about.
No.
And also the EU referendum in the UK as well is apparently going to be on their plate. Now, I would imagine that they're also going to discuss the looming spectre of Russia. Earlier last week, two US F-22s, which are extremely advanced and sexy-looking fighter planes, were flown out to Romania in a show of support for the region. Of course, another part of Europe that has been threatened by Russia is the Scandinavian area. So I'm sure there's going to be a lot to discuss.
Well, threatened is a bit tough. They've tweaked the tail, haven't they? They've kind of made them feel a bit edgy. They've kind of maybe sent some submarines into their fjords.
They've roughed them up a little bit, I think.
Oh, I think, yeah.
Do you think that's too strong, Andrew?
You have reservations
about that phrasing.
I think roughing up would involve a little bit of a fisticuff. And I think it's more kind of brinkmanship and unnerving.
They're eyeing them across the dance floor. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, maybe kind of kicking them in the backside when they're not looking.
Sure.
But no actual kind of like fisticuffs yet.
I think it's more like, have you read The Twits by Roald Dahl, where he keeps on putting a tiny bit of cork on the end of Mrs. Twit's walking stick, so he slowly undermines her over the years. I think it's a bit more like that.
I think that maybe
suspicious, you know, kind of like a strange, insidious sort of light bullying.
An extremely
strange.
Well,
analogy.
I think that might be one of those apt analogies that has been drawn for the geopolitical situation in Europe so far.
Well, good. That's what I'm here for. Okay.
On the 5th of May, coming close to home, there is, of course, the mayoral election being held in London. Zach Goldsmith is going to head off against Sadiq Khan. It's an extremely interesting election, bringing in a little bit of urbanism for Andrew. I read an excellent article in the Financial Times magazine by their political editor, George Parker, talking about how the Conservatives can no longer rely on what was colloquially referred to as the donut strategy, assuming that the outer reaches of London were theirs, because the housing crisis has pushed traditionally Labour-supporting groups out into that area, which I thought was a really interesting piece of analysis. Also worth mentioning that Khan would be the first Muslim mayor of a Western capital city, which I think would be a significant development globally.
What is your favourite sort of donut? Do you go for the ring donut, the jam, or the sometimes a sort of custard cream donut?
Disappointed with the custard.
Yeah, I'd go jam all the way.
Always disappointed.
Andrew?
I don't mind a custard one when you're in Italy.
Yeah.
There's something quite nice about that kind of creme fraiche custardy thing they have, which I like.
Yeah.
I don't really like donuts, though. I have to be honest.
Really?
I don't like donuts.
My donut strategy is lots and often.
I'm always suspicious of platters of donuts because there's no way of telling what they contain from the outside.
Really, you like it to be labelled. When you receive a box of chocolates, or when sometimes one arrives at reception here at Midori House, do you look at the instructions or do you pile straight in?
Chocolates are different. I'm talking about donuts here.
Yeah,
I think
you could. I could tie you.
I'm not an instruction reader, actually.
Okay.
I tend to like to take the risk. A risk taker.
You don't need many instructions when eating a donut, do you? Place in mouth and chew.
Well, I mean, that's, you know, again, I think it's a different kettle of fish, isn't it? It's the label. I want to know what's inside.
There's no fish involved. Anyway, give me one more.
One more?
Yeah, one more.
Okay, if it's one more, then I'm going to go with this one. It's Hedgehog Awareness Week.
Oh, good. I like this kind of thing.
Or next week, the British Hedgehog Preservation Society is holding its Hedgehog Awareness Week. This week, I printed off the press announcement, they're going to be focusing on strimmers and cutting machines. I've provided a picture here of a hedgehog being threatened by a piece of garden equipment.
Like a strimmer. Now,
they are advocating for practical steps to be taken to protect hedgehogs' lives, including placing warning stickers. You know the safety stickers that you get on strimmers?
Yeah.
Kind of like with a picture, silhouette of a hand going into it.
Yeah.
To include a hedgehog silhouette in those safety instructions.
Yeah, good for them. I'd include that.
Yeah, I think that should be law.
I'd
pass that. That'd be my first thing if I was Prime Minister.
You know what they do? You should if you are any sort of city dweller anywhere where the hedgehog is indigenous, you need to drill a hole through your wall or your fence to allow them to go from one garden to the next, because they're roaming creatures. They can roam quite a long way and they need to roam, because if they stay stuck in one garden, if you've got quite a big garden, they die in there. They get trapped.
What, just of claustrophobia?
No, they need more food. They need to reproduce. They need to wander around. Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah, yeah.
Are you speaking from personal experience? Have you had a bad hedgehog?
I think probably this was something I remember from school, as they used to say, make sure you get, you know, you drill a hole in your fence.
You're also meant to ensure that there's an easy route out of ponds and pools.
Yeah.
I'm not sure what that would look like, though.
Well, no, it's a little ladder. You put a little kind of piece of wood in with
like an escape.
So they can climb their way out.
Sure.
Yeah. So you thought we'd know nothing about this, did you?
If you have a bonfire, you have to be very careful if you make a kind of like a wood pile and then set it alight, because hedgehogs think, oh, here's a place to nest. So in November, they begin to kind of hibernate in your fire. Then you set it alight and you're like, oh, that's a no. Now we've got treats instead.
Yeah, exactly. The thinking man's marshmallow.
I am verifying these claims, and they're all true.
The spiky donut.
Again, there's the spot list.
The spiky donut.
Sure. Yeah. No, spiky no need for that at the end.
it looks like a jam filling, but it certainly isn't.
Okay, Henry, thank you for a rather disturbing end to the show.
Thanks very much, Andrew.
German fine art photographer Wolfgang Tillmans is a creative force whose story has been intertwined with the UK since the mid-1980s, when British youth culture first caught his camera's eye. Living between Berlin and London, Tillmans was also the first non-Brit to win the annual Turner Prize, awarded to those pushing the boundaries in art.
Now Tillmans is making his affection for the UK known by voicing his concerns over the current debate over the country's future in the EU. He doesn't want the UK to leave, and has this week produced a series of striking new posters to make the point. They feature images photographed from high above the continent in a plane and slogans such as "What is lost forever." Wolfgang Tillmans joins us on the phone now from Berlin. Wolfgang, welcome to the programme. And first of all, I wonder if you feel it's definitely the job of the artist to roll his sleeves up and become embroiled in a debate like this.
No, it's not particularly the role of the artist, but I am really doing this as me, as of course I want to use the voice that I have as an artist, but it is not that I feel as an artist I speak here. It is really just that this subject is of such incredible importance to me and to Europe, I believe, that I feel I don't want to wake up on the 24th of June and think that I could have done more.
And Wolfgang, tell me, when you decided to do this, it's, you know, moving into the realm of, you know, political advertising in a way, but you've done it in a very Wolfgang Tillmans striking way. In many ways, the images aren't shouty; they're very cool and calm, and it's the words on the page that grab you as well. What was your approach? Why did you decide to choose these aerial images?
First of all, I felt that the Remain campaign is lacking positive messages, passion, and good visuals, and it's something that I wanted to imbue with a positive vibe, you know, because it's so easy to talk down the EU, but the question is, what is the alternative? Because the moment that Britain exits the EU, it would possibly cascade into the dissolution of the EU, because I mean, I believe that the majority definitely is pro-EU. It's just a question of mobilization of the voters. I really think people think through where we are now and do we really want to go back to every nation for themselves in a world where around the borders of the EU there are people like Putin and Erdogan and other autocratic rulers who really would only benefit from a destabilization of the EU and its values for free speech, democracy, and human rights. You know, do we really want to weaken that institution in this moment now? I feel if we look at it like that, the majority will definitely be for continuity. And in terms of the language that I use, I didn't want to do something confrontational, but on the other hand, I wanted to also spell it out very clearly, you know, like, for example, the fact that you have to be registered before the 7th of June. So, you know, when the debate heats up in the last 2 weeks, nobody who hasn't registered until the 7th of June will be allowed to vote. So I'm thinking very practically. I think everybody who has a Glastonbury ticket should definitely use their postal vote, because Glastonbury is actually happening during the referendum.
You just mentioned in your last answer, Wolfgang, the language that you used. I was interested in the copywriting, in fact, as these are advertisements. And although you might share very different views, the style of them actually reminded me of the Saatchi campaigns for the Conservative Party in the early 1980s. They're really bold. They're really catchy. Say you're in if you're in. No man's an island, no country by itself. We obviously know that riffs off sort of classical poetry. But how much did you collaborate with the rest of your studio to come up with the words themselves?
It is a lot my own words and Paul Hutchinson in the Berlin studio and Annette Kotek in the London studio. And by the way, No Man is an Island is, of course, the famous John Donne quote, but the second part, No Country by Itself, Paul actually added. And this...
It's a nice writing credit to share on with John Donne, isn't it?
Isn't it? He was quite chuffed, I think.
Yeah.
And for example, "What is lost forever" is a line that I wrote some months ago in general about a sentiment of that sometimes there's regulatory or populist activism that then suddenly shuts down things, shuts down something that once it's gone forever. It's not that if we shut down the EU that it will rematerialize in 3 years. You know, you have to be clear this is something that has really long-term ramifications. And the wording, it was the result of many weeks of thinking of how to frame this and because I'm so passionate about the thing. For example, like I wanted to list the detractors of the EU, because something really powerful happens when you look at the list of the detractors and you wonder, do you really want to be in that club? You know, you may not want to be in the Brussels club, but do you really want to be in bed with ISIS, Putin, Murdoch, the BNP, and George Galloway?
that's a really big, sexy double bed, isn't it?
Yes.
Wolfgang, do you think there's a benefit? Often when you, any kind of situation, when you stand outside it every now and then, you see things a little bit more clearly. I wonder what somebody who has a foot both in and outside of the UK, jumping back between Berlin and London, do you see when you stand from a distance, more clearly, do you think, than some other people, what might be lost?
I think so. You know, I see myself very much as not a product of post-war European history, but yes, I am, you know, like I'm living a European reality between two countries and, of course, in many other EU countries. And I feel this, there is actually a sense of connection that a lot of us feel with each other, with our sisters and brothers in Europe. And I didn't want to shy away even from this bordering on happy clappy term, we are the European family. You know, it's a question of where you feel you belong. And this sort of UKIP sloganeering for like a British more nationalist angle, I think is not shared by many, many other people. And they feel actually, I mean, like myself, I feel like I am actually part of the European family. And when you, for example, look at the EU Charter, I think point 3 is right on top. It says no man can be put to death by capital punishment. And that made my heart beat up, you know, like 508 million people joined together and signed that. And that's not what you'll be doing as a citizen of the US, of Russia, of China. So the European Union is really also a very good thing, a very cool thing, and it has to actually be rebranded, and we have to love it, learn to love it a little bit more, rather than just think it's like sort of an unbeloved parent that will never go away. You know, it is now in danger of actually disappearing.
And just finally, Wolfgang, if Germany was voting to leave the EU, would you run a similar campaign for a German audience as you're running for a British one? I wonder if you feel that the way that you have to angle what you're saying is specific to Britain and what those specifics are.
I mean, fortunately, we are far away in Germany from that being questioned. No? Like 85% of voters in recent elections voted in favor of Angela Merkel's policies. Only 15% voted far right, which is, I mean, scary enough that happened within a year, that the vote jumped from 3% to 15%. But the majority in Germany is largely for the EU. You know, we don't know. Things are moving so fast right now. You know, like Austria had a 40% far right vote last weekend. I think the minority is at the moment determining the dialogue in many, many places. You know, like not all Americans are crazy far right, but the far right in America is dominating the dialogue. And I think we have to bring it all back a little bit more to the center and imbue the center with passion and love.
Well said. Wolfgang Tillmans, thank you very much for joining us. We should say, actually, that one of the points in your campaign is that people can simply go on your website, print them off, download them, print them off, put them up, if they so desire. And that is tillmans.co.uk. Wolfgang, thank you very much for your time.
Great. Thank you.
All right, time for some music now. This is from Tegan and Sarah, the Canadian duo who made a visit to Midori House for a great session a couple of years back. Suitably enough, following the conversation we've just had, it is called U-Turn. Now I want to write a love song, even though you never ever asked me for one. Write you a letter, send sweet poems, ask for forgiveness, tell you I was wrong. Sit myself down, read my pride in, start to focus, change who I've been. Give me a second, let me U-turn, write you the love song you've earned. And that was Tegan and Sarah with U-Turn. You're tuned in to the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24.
Stay one step ahead of the breaking news.
Refugees are entering the European Union and, for that matter, the Schengen area at Greece. And nothing is being done either by Greece or by the European Union as a whole.
Hear industry-leading insights from our experts.
The way Apple Pay works is that it uses the same technology that a contactless credit card, but that only works with a contactless card reader.
And catch up with Monocle's bureau around the world.
Being Japan, they're very confident that there will be a stadium by spring 2020, even though at the moment there's no design and no architect. So I don't know, fingers crossed at this point.
Every weekday at noon London time, keep your appointment with The Briefing on Monocle 24.
Alan Kitchen is a celebrated typographer and letterpress printing expert whose work has appeared across titles such as the Financial Times and The Guardian, plus locations across London, including the city's famous food spot, Borough Market. He is also the founder of the Typography Workshop in Clerkenwell and has taught the technique of letterpress printing at the Royal College of Art.
Alan's letterpress prints are currently on show as part of the Pick Me Up Graphic Arts Festival at London's Somerset House. The show is called Alan Kitching, A Life in Letterpress, and Alan has a brand new book out of the same name. He's here to discuss these and hopefully give us some top tips on how to become letterpress printing masters too. We'll see how that goes. Anna, welcome to the Monocle Weekly. And thanks for having us. It feels like a coronation year or something for Alan Kitching. We've got the book, we've got the show, there's a lot of stuff going on. How's it feel to look back on all this stuff when you're still so busy working at the moment as well?
The book, which you mentioned, started about 12 years ago, actually, by my late wife. She was a writer, a singer and a performer and an artist, very talented woman. She started the book off. And she died, unfortunately, in 2010. So everything kind of disappeared. And it got picked up again by Lawrence King, the publisher.
Yeah.
He said to me, well, you know, we need like to do the book. And I can't really write. So we asked John Walters of I Magazine, who was a very good writer and, you know, knowledgeable of graphics. And between him and the art director of I Magazine, Simon Esterson, who own and run the magazine, International Graphic Design Magazine, they took the book on. And Simon designed it and John wrote it, basically. And my archivist, I have two archivists, and they were dredging up material from 60 years ago, which had completely... How it survived, I don't know. But things did, photographs and cuttings and work and jobs and all sorts of things. It all came to light. A lot of it's in the exhibition and a lot of it's in the book. So the book, in a sense, has got nothing to do with me.
luckily, it bears your name.
It bears my name, but they've passed it in front of me. But I really let things go. I said, "Well, are you sure you're going to put that in?" He said, "Oh, yeah, that's a good photograph. Oh, that's a good whatever." And so, well, if you're doing the book, not me, you know. So you do it. So I let them do what they wanted, really.
Alan, the work in the book, as you say, spans a huge period of time, but it's made clear this is still relevant, appetizing, appealing, wanted by lots of different people. But the strange thing is we're at a moment when, you know, you step out the front door here, you can see so much typography. Anybody with a laptop can create typography, Why do you think your craft-based work has really kind of cut through all that noise and really maintained its relevance?
Well, when I started, I had no idea it would snowball into this effect. I just wanted to do what I was doing, using the material and the type and the presses that I'd learned long ago from. I knew, of course, that mode of printing is finished and obsolete and dead. And I had to try and, if you like, reinvent the invention of printing. Because in the beginning, of course, it was all in white paper and black ink. And if you wanted decoration, you had to use red. And I knew I had to break that mould of that traditional method of printing. It was finished anyway. So I explored colour. I just worked on my own for 3 or 4 years. I had one very good apprentice, and I just experimented, and it slowly and surely got out there. You know, I got commissioned by various magazines, like The Guardian and the Financial Times I did work for. One of the pieces I've just done for London Transport, the new poster for the centenary of Edward Johnson, who designed the underground lettering, that came out in 1916. This year's 100 years since. And they're doing a suite of posters. I did one of those. The magazine called Computer Arts, I've picked it up. They want to use it. I mean, I'm as far removed from computer art as you can possibly get. And there we are, you know, to answer your question. How it comes back on itself, I don't know, really. I think because it's obviously a handmade image. Each image is unique, even though I'm printing a series. They're all slightly different, where the tradition of printing was that you made absolute identical copies. And I didn't want to do that. I wanted to break that mould as well, to take us somewhere else, the actual physicality of the printing process. And it, as I say, it took a long time to sort of work out. I'm still working, you know, 20 years later, I'm still working it out.
And what's the, I'd love to know the day-to-day, Alan, of what you do. There's a lot of nice pictures in the book of you with your apron on, with inky fingers, all the rest of it. By the way, we promised people some sound effects at the beginning of this, didn't we? You brought some type in. Shall we unwrap it from its newspaper while we describe this?
Yeah. Traditionally, printers always dropped their type up like this.
Dropped their H's.
And it always dropped them in newspaper.
Yeah.
So what I've got here is a newspaper package.
Can I just weight that? Can I give that a... Can I hold that?
Yeah, well, it's wood and metal in there. Yeah. It's not that heavy, but...
It's a good weight.
You can just
heavier than a mouse mass, you know.
Yeah. Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah. So what, do you feel very attuned? Your hands must be so attuned to the weight, the depth, the amount of ink that this type puts on the paper, all the rest of it. Is this something you can kind of do in your sleep? Do these feel like old friends in your hands?
He says banging an apostrophe.
That is a comma.
Oh, sorry.
You got it upside down.
I'm around the wrong way, you see.
Yeah.
Come and have a look.
That's the biggest comma you'll probably ever see. I brought some wood type, which you can hear.
What are these made of? What's the wood?
Oh, it's a hard wood. It's like a fruit, a pear or something like that.
And the skill of being a printer is, do you make all these yourself? All
no,
the wood
no.
blocks? Or you go to...
No, these are from a collection I've got, a vast collection, which we bought from a printer who was closing down in 1996. It was a printer who printed all the posters for the theatres and cinemas throughout Britain. And he had a vast collection of every size of type. I mean, I've just brought a couple of sizes here. And we bought the whole collection of him. So I'm using existing prefabricated pieces, if you like, very fixed sizes. For instance, these letters here, the A and the T is kind of interlocked. And it's very... It's very odd to describe this on the radio because you should see it on television, really.
Yeah.
But you can see how it's interlocked, right?
Yeah.
Put the H next to it there. That is called kerning. People use the word kerning now for the computer function. But it came from cutting bits of type like that, so the arm of the T sits inside the space of the A. If they weren't like that, they would be too far apart.
That could be a newspaper headline. That could be part of a word.
Yeah. If you put them, that's it, that, like that, there'd be a gap.
Amazing. So it's a very simple form, but it's very responsive to your needs.
The paradox is it's a very awkward medium.
Yeah.
Unyielding. At the same time, it's very subtle. This is the sort of attraction of it, I think. This is a composing stick, this metal thing. The composing stick was set to make columns of type. So if you were doing a book, you'd have a certain length, you know, like these newspaper columns here. The composing stick is rather like a builder's hod.
Yeah.
Where you put bricks in it and you stack them up. You're stacking up the type. So that type is made of lead, basically. The bit when it gets bigger sizes, it's made of wood. Because you imagine that made of lead, you wouldn't be able to pick it up.
And tell me, some of your works, you know, they sit in galleries, they sit in collections, people hunt them down. But what's interesting when you look through the book, you know, here you are using the same technique, the same probably these same blocks to do work for, say, a beautiful, beautiful wine label, yeah. and then a kind of angry campaign poster as well. Yeah. When you sit down with all the letters and with the inks and things, is there a kind of a sense that you know how you will provoke people or bring people along in the way that you're using them?
Yes, I mean, typography got its own voice. As you say, between a wine label and a protest banner, you're still using the same medium, but you have to make the choice. Some type looks as though it may be used for one particular subject rather than another. I mean, I've used it for both. I mean, I've done postage stamps, which look like banners. I've done wine labels as well. You can mix it up. It's a question of the typeface and the colour of the ink and how I ink it.
We're in a kind of, a world of polished perfection.
Yeah.
In a way, everything you do has a slight air of, not being repeatable. Slight air of almost flaw in a way.
We don't like perfection. It's perfect in its imperfections. Printing uses, like all this paper on the desk, it's got a very clean cut sharp edge. The printing press works on the right angle. The paper I use, it's got a ragged edge. It's called a deckle edge because it's handmade paper. Anything handmade has imperfections in it. That's another attraction which I've got. The type, the paper, the hand inking, the hand printing, everything is controlled by hand and eye. Even though I'm trying to, within an edition of prints, I'm trying to make them identical, but they're actually not. And that's what I like to do.
Do you work on instinct, Alan? Is it?
What I do is I get a commission, say.
Yeah.
Say the cover of the book, which I did myself. It took me a long time to work it out. I mean, I know it's my own name and everything, but it's the same principle for another job. Like, which letter do you make big? How do you fit them all together? And that's done by, I have a sketchbook. So I do a little sketch to begin with. Then I do an actual size rough, sometimes with tissue paper. And then I do it with the type itself. So there's a process from the initial idea to before you start to put ink on the type.
And are you surprised at the general revival in interest in the letterpress? Because they seem to be all being kind of scrapped and thrown away, and now...
When I started in 1988, 89, and there was a couple of people in London, they weren't doing what I was doing. They were printers, basically. And I wasn't interested in that, printing people's wedding invitations, But since I started, and it got out there, through The Guardian mainly, because that was my first big client, when they were in Farringdon Road, they were neighbours of mine, and teaching at the college, the students were totally absorbed in it. And now there's lots of little letterpress studios all over the place. And in Europe, in the States. And it came, if I may say so, from Clerkenwell.
But it speaks to our yearning for something, that is less digital, that's more...
There's something in the air about the digital technology. It is perfection. I mean, the scanning, the colour reproduction is fantastic. The more that advances, I'm better off, because they can reproduce what I do absolutely faithfully. But I think there's something in the air about the handmade which people like, whether it's a loaf of bread or a pair of shoes. I just think it's in the air.
You've talked about The Guardian, and there's some beautiful work here, Farringdon, right in the middle of a map here of something that was an advert for the typography workshop that you did. Who've been your favourite clients over the years? What have been your favourite pieces of work?
Well, I've done work for the Globe Theatre. Done work for the National Theatre. They were very nice jobs, I think. I've done wine labels. I did Royal Mail stamps.
We should point people in the direction of the rather beautiful book then, Alan Kitching, A Life in Letterpress. Also, if you're in town this weekend, at London's Somerset House, an exhibition of the same name. Yep. Alan Kitching, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Just grow like a tree with the roots very deep on earth.
For the best in food and hospitality, tune into The Menu.
I learned that from a potato farmer way up in northern Maine. And he baked me a potato and it was like eating the best thing ever.
Monaco's programme on food and drink introduces you to the most inspirational chefs, dedicated producers and innovative restaurateurs.
Some cinnamon syrup, a half an ounce of that. Got our Bosca Schnapps, an ounce of this.
So when you need inspiration for your dinner plans or want to find a new place for a superb cocktail, tune into The Menu with me, Markus Hippi, premiering every Friday at 1900 London time.
It was really the River Cafe where I really just had a deep relationship with carrots. Vegetables, sorry, I should have said carrots, but I love carrots. I meant vegetables in general.
Since the 1970s, the green spaces of New York's Central Park have had one particular force of nature on their side, Elizabeth Barlow Rogers. In the late 1970s, when New York was suffering one of its lowest periods of financial neglect, the writer and activist became the Central Park administrator. And in the 1980s, Rogers also created the Central Park Conservancy, a public-private partnership that restored the park.
She now heads up the not-for-profit Foundation for Landscape Studies, and she's still constantly surveying the land. Her latest book is Green Metropolis, The Extraordinary Landscapes of New York City as Nature, History and Design. The book focuses on some of the more peaceful nooks in the New York area, from the High Line to the FDR Memorial on Roosevelt Island. And she joins us now. Elizabeth, welcome to the programme. And first of all, maybe we could put you and Central Park into context. When was the last time you took the air in the park and scribbled some notes for a future book?
Oh, about an hour ago.
That's a good question, wasn't it?
Just tell us your relationship with that park. You helped bring it back to life, as we said, and restore it. But what is the nature of restoring a park like that? Because I guess over time, how we see our parks evolves and changes. And what was, you know, appreciated 20 years ago is very different now. We tend to think of our parks being a little bit rougher around the edges. How has your work with that park matured and changed over time too?
Well, let me go back just a little bit. You mentioned my new book, which is Green Metropolis, Nature, History, and Landscape in New York City. And when I was a new New Yorker, we're going back now to 1964, I appropriated this city heart and soul, and I wanted to explore it in its entirety. My first book, The Forests and Wetlands of New York City, is about the outlying green spaces, the nature in New York, the abundant nature, which most people don't even realize is here. And this book is a return to some of those same places, as well as some of the newer green spaces that you mentioned, such as the High Line and the Roosevelt Memorial. But Central Park, to get back to your question, is totally man-made, totally designed. Few people realize that. After writing my first book, I said, who is this forgotten genius, Frederick Law Olmsted? Frederick Law Olmsted is the designer of Central Park. He and his collaborator, Calvert Vaux, in 1858 won the competition for the design of the park. They named their winning entry Greensward. And that whole attitude of having the park as a scenic recreation experience was lost over time. In the 20th century, recreation facilities were built. Well, that's all right. The idea of giving sports and more athletic forms of recreation as culture changed, making that possible in the park, that's fine. But what wasn't fine was what happened. And the 1970s, because by this time you had a whole shift in world culture, really, in Britain, but particularly here in the United States. There was the protests against the Vietnam War, there were rock concerts, there were love-ins, be-ins, happenings, all sorts of things. Where would they be? In Central Park, of course. Management threw up its hands. The park department was simply not doing its job. The workforce was demoralized. And before you knew it, the park was a dust bowl. And when I was learning about Frederick Law Olmsted and this great masterpiece of American landscape design. I thought that the people of New York, the citizens of New York, have to care. And this grew out of a very, I call it a Pollyanna-ish idea, that if government couldn't do it, the people of New York could save their park. And they did. And it's been a wonderful, wonderful career for me. I have returned to my career as a writer and a editor of a journal called Sightlines, which is part of the mission of the Foundation for Landscape Studies, of which I'm president. But I want to go back, since you asked about Central Park, and tell you that the park's restoration began with the creation of the Central Park Conservancy, and that's the first public-private partnership for a park in history, really. And the idea that citizens could partner with government, not just write editorials and say what government should be doing, but actually be a force, and having an appointment that made me official within the Park Department was crucial. In 1979, the newly elected mayor, Edward Koch, appointed a fine man named Gordon Davis as his park commissioner. Gordon saw what I was doing, and he brought me into city government, and that was key. But
Elizabeth, just to dive in there, we want to, there's so much cover in your book, and we do want to make sure that we bring in some of the other elements. But just tell us, you know, when we look today at something like the High Line, then do you compare the two in their ambition and their desire to, you know, to bring health and activity and, you know, the world of landscape to New Yorkers in the same way? Do you think there is a connection between the two?
Oh, absolutely. When Robert Hammond and his co-founder, Josh Davis, were starting, Robert Hammond and Joshua David were starting the Friends of the High Line. They came to me, and how do you start a conservancy? How do you do a public-private partnership? And so this was inspiration, a little bit of inspiration. The rest is history, and this wonderful, marvelous addition, unusual kind of parkscape, has been so successful that cities everywhere are looking for elevated pieces of rustic train lines, rail tracks, industrial infrastructure to build parks on now.
And I just wondered your view of the city, Elizabeth. Do you feel that it's sort of man's intervention in a city that, or nature's intervention in man's city that is very beautiful? I mean, are you a great fan of the great outdoors and the wilderness, or do you feel that it's rather beautiful that this huge park actually is surrounded by the gridiron of Manhattan?
Well, I think it's simply wonderful that the city is so abundant with nature. People don't realize that maybe 40%, when you count all of the green spaces, the ones that I speak about in my book, it is all nature. Here is the way my preface begins. Green metropolis, New York City. It sounds like a dichotomy. It is not. So it really is the fact that you have this wonderful city filled with humanity and skyscrapers and structures and people, but there is wonderful, wonderful nature, and we have access to it.
And I just wondered, do you read the park? I mean, nature is red in tooth and claw. Do you see that in Central Park, or do you read this park in a beautiful way, like you would read a painting? Do you know what I mean? Do you have an aesthetic or a very practical relationship with it? I wonder.
It's an aesthetic, and I must tell you, this aesthetic grows out really of the aesthetic of the English landscape. When you think about the great landscape designers of the 18th century, Capability Brown, Humphrey Repton, these were the forebears, really, of Olmsted and Vaux, who created Central Park. Scenery is paramount. Scenic recreation is paramount. Yes, the park is recreation. Yes, I'm there every day jogging around. My husband's a marathon runner. It's good for physical recreation, but first and foremost, it's beautiful. It is a masterpiece of American art.
And just tell me, one of the elements of your book looks at, you know, that the past, how we felt that you could, you know, dump garbage in landfills and then cover it with a bit of park. That kind of relationship to how we build parks is changing a little bit as well. You know, that we do seem to have a better appreciation that nature needs to be looked after and defended more. Are you hopeful that we're at a point of time in how we treat parks and our green spaces that for New York and for other cities is actually rather good?
I think so, and I think there really has been a renaissance, not just in this city, but you really look across the country. You see Louisville, Kentucky building a wonderful additional park system for the 21st century. You see beyond the one that Frederick Law Olmsted laid out, Central Park's designer, you know, he went all over the country, and more parks were designed with Central Park as the prototype. But now, green spaces and defenders of green spaces, they are out there, and it's really remarkable and a wonderful thing.
Well, here's to that. Elizabeth, thank you very much for your time. The book is Green Metropolis, The Extraordinary Landscapes of New York City as Nature, History and Design. And the author was Elizabeth Barlow Rogers. Thank you very much. Mm-hmm. 256 editions of the Monocle Weekly. Down, Andrew.
Boom.
256, all raring to go and ready to rock, probably.
Thank you very much. And I'm going to go away now. I'm going to go on my holidays.
You know how this sometimes at the end of the show there's a bit of banter. There's a bit of, didn't we enjoy that? You really
no,
need to
I did
get
enjoy.
Really,
Can
you've
I just,
a, have you got a helicopter idling no. in the car park of Midori House?
Is no, I think we've discussed on the show before. I'm certainly in the Brexit vote. I want to stay part of the European family, as Wolfgang Tillmans described it, for many reasons. But partly, I think, you know, he's a little bit younger than me, not that much. And I think that what he talks about, this kind of notion of like post, you know, Second World War, the idea of some kind of greater family that, you know, it has been a club for peace. And while we kind of forget that too much because we have so much harumphing about things that quite legitimately don't go right and people are right to be cross about them, I think if they could get back to some of those ideals, there's something in there that is really important. So I really enjoyed hearing from Wolfgang Tillmans. And I think that what he's done, everyone should go and download those posters, at least have a look at them, even if you're opposed to his views. You know, it's just a nice intervention. It's a non-shouty intervention in the imagery he uses, but it's a very effective one.
I say hear, hear to that. Also, an interesting thing, there's a lot of talk of sovereignty in the Leave campaign, but very little talk of sovereignty in the Stay campaign. And he basically used sovereignty as a pro rather than an anti thing, which was rather nice. I wish both sides of the argument, at least here in the UK, could be as high-minded and charming as he was, actually.
Yeah,
I'm undecided, but I feel that, you know, his was a calm voice.
Yeah, and you know, as we said, he's, you know, you could tell he was very considered about what he was doing. And I just do think it's interesting that, you know, he is a reflection of not just for, you know, an elite like him. I think there are many people in the UK who live lives which are a little bit more mixed like his. You know, so he lives in two different countries, you know, he's got different parentage. And I think there are many people who feel the same, you know, that they've worked abroad, they don't feel themselves to be kind of trapped by being defined by just one place. And for those people, I hope there is a chance for us to stay and remain.
Can be more apt. I wonder where people are listening to the show around the world. Let us, on that note, thank our pals behind the glass. Today's show is produced by Tom Hall, researched by Gaia Lutz, Ilse Viveros and Mariah Grenina, and our studio manager was Claire Urban. The Monocle Weekly will, of course, be back same time, same place next week, but sans the holidaying Andrew Tuck. So from me, Robert Bound.
And me, Andrew Tuck.
Thanks for tuning in.